Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. A truly remarkable and exceptional story is about to be told on the morning show. That of a family that at first glance might seem to be particularly ordinary in every single way. But there is, at the heart of this family, a most uncommon story. The book at hand is called Raising Ryland, Our Story of Parenting a Transgender Child with No Strings Attached. It's written by Hillary Whittington. When she and her husband, Jeff, began their family, it was with what seemed to be a beautiful, perfectly normal little girl. As it turns out, there were a couple of things that made their daughter something different. The first thing was profound hearing loss. She was profoundly deaf. And so part of this story is of them coming to grips with this reality and of some of the remarkable, the things that were done on behalf of her. But then came what was in many respects an even bigger shock when it became increasingly clear that their daughter, emotionally and mentally, although physically female, was, in fact, a boy. And the question of what they should do about this, how they should act on it, if they should act on it, should what was the best way for them to safeguard the well-being and happiness of their child? It's a staggeringly complicated story, which they managed to weather with great grace and sensitivity, but with some bumps along the way, all described beautifully in this remarkable memoir, again called Raising Ryland, Our Story of Parenting a Transgender Child with No Strings Attached, now a paperback from William Morrow. Hillary Whittington, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg.
This is really an incredible story. And of course, you and your husband and your two children have lived it. I wonder what it felt like to take the step of deciding to actually sit down and write about it. Did that mark any sort of special leap of faith on your part? Or did that feel like you were sort of setting off into uncharted territory by sharing the story in this way?
You know what? I actually wanted to write a book years ago, and I felt I had to, just because of everything we had gone through. And I knew that there wasn't a television program or, you know, an interview in any way that could really describe what we went through. And so I just felt that a book was a great way to tell the story in its entirety and really get into the depths of our emotion and what we all went through. So this is something I've been wanting to do for a while. I'm just happy that it's finally completed.
It's very, very well done. I don't want to leap too far ahead into the heart of the story, but I do want to ask you something very, very specific. This is not only the story of what you experienced as Ryan's mother, but it's also the story of what your husband, his dad, Jeff, experienced, and the rest of your family and your circle of close friends and so on. And I so appreciate the honesty with which you share about all of this, including the sort of momentary hesitancies and sometimes in certain cases, much longer term hesitancy and bewilderment over this. I mean, you are so blessed, as is Ryland, to have a family which is in so many ways so supportive and so loving. But you, of course, would not be telling the complete story if you didn't also share some of the other part of this experience in terms of some of these loved ones. Can you just talk for a moment about how difficult it was to share about those kind of sort of darker facets of this story. I mean, especially involving close family, close friends, and so on. How difficult was that for you? And what did you think about as you set about with that particular task?
You know, thank goodness for my co-author, Christine Gasberry, because she really forced me to dive into those emotions that really weren't fun for me to go back to. And to be honest with you, writing this book was very therapeutic because there were so many parts of the last few years that were just so intense and emotionally draining. And it was difficult to be honest, even, you know, about some of our family not understanding right away. But at the same time, I felt that honesty was the only way to go because that's how some of the world feels. And so I wanted people to be able to relate to the fact that this wasn't just some easy overnight decision. And everybody questioned us, of course, at first, because it was a little bit of a shock, especially at Ryland's young age. But once our family and friends really started researching for themselves, they recognized that this was the best thing to do. So I'm grateful that they allowed me to share, you know, the entire story. And it wasn't always pretty. But, you know, it's really the truth. And it wasn't an easy road at all. So I want the world to see that this came with a lot of thought and grief.
Mm. I wonder if you could say a word about a very noteworthy video, which is the way in which a lot of people might know something about your story and Ryland's story. A video which I actually watched for the first time earlier today on YouTube, and I was over 700,000 people have viewed it before me, so a lot of people know their story from that. What were you hoping to accomplish by taking the story, in a sense, a step further?
So the video actually came out about 2 years ago, and one of the reasons that we made that video was to help educate the staff at Ryland School when he first went into kindergarten. So that was actually, that came before the book. And the video was a great way for us to come out to some of our friends and family that we were just meeting for the, not friends and family, but friends that we were just meeting for the first time. And that video actually went viral, you know, a couple years back. And during the last couple of years, this is the time that I've taken to write the story in its entirety. So it's kind of how it all went down. But our intention wasn't initially to release that video. It was just to use it personally to educate people around us.
Mm. And so, I remember in the book at some point when some people begin saying, you know, this really needs to be shared with the wider world, you and your husband were somewhat reluctant. I mean, that was a big step for you to take, to,
absolutely,
in a sense, share Ryland's story so publicly, so widely, not having, right, any way of knowing what the ramifications for that might possibly be.
Right. And our first concern was Ryland's safety. I was scared to death that somebody would want to harm us because of what we had done. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why I felt I needed to come out and talk about this, because we aren't the only ones in this situation. And this population of people is suffering tremendously all over the world. And so I felt there had to be somebody who would come out and share that really we didn't do anything wrong. This is something that Ryland was born this way. And we just decided to support him. And I really believe that the next generation of transgender children will be much happier and hopefully healthier and not want to fall into that 41% of attempted suicide rate. So really, I mean, at the same time, we've been following Ryland's lead. Granted, he's a very young child, but he's very proud of who he is. And he's actually the one that asked to share that video initially. And so we knew, obviously, he didn't know what was coming, but we didn't want to squash his pride and make him feel afraid of being who he really is. So that was sort of what was behind all of it.
Hmm. We're speaking with Hillary Whittington, and we are talking about the memoir she has written called Raising Ryland, Our Story of Parenting a Transgender Child with No Strings Attached. Chapter one begins in, I think, somewhat surprising fashion. I mean, it isn't enormously surprising, mildly surprising, though, that you decide to begin your book with a sense, the love story of you and your husband, Jeff, in terms of when you first met, when you first fell in love, when you saw this big brawny guy on the beach and so on. I mean, all that you describe. And in that respect, it seems like a perfectly ordinary story. I mean, we have no sense at that moment where this story is going to take us. I'm just curious if there was any particular reason why you wanted to begin your story in this very sort of unassuming way.
You know, because we are just typical people. You know, I really consider us just your average run-of-the-mill couple. We went to college, fell in love, thought that our future was going to consist of having a family and my husband being a fireman, me being a stay-at-home mom. And I really relate to being a typical person. And so I guess I wanted the world to know that this can happen to anyone. And I never, ever thought in a million years I would be in the shoes I am now, 10 years ago. So I guess that's why I wanted to just bring a human aspect to the story, that we're just people trying to do the best we can.
You take us in chapter two to the birth of Ryland, and you describe something that I think is really pretty amazing, and it's, of course, something that just about every set of new parents experience with their newborn baby right there in the delivery room. But I don't know that I've ever read an account that really made this point as well as you do. You talk about watching the video that was made of that birth, and of course the tearful joy when finally Ryland is delivered. And you write, "Every time I watch the video, I remember how surreal it was for me to hear the voice of the little human whose whole entire life until minutes before had taken place silently inside of me. When I witness the experience now more than 7 years later, I remember the sheer awe I felt with every sound she made as soon as she entered the world. How long has she had that voice, I wondered, and what was she trying to tell us?" Did that occur to you at the time, or only years later did that the wonder of that moment, of that aspect of it, occur to you? Or even in the moment, were you taken by just that remarkable sound of her voice for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, I can't, as a mother, it's so hard to describe those first moments when your child enters the world. I mean, granted, I had been grieving my brother's passing, and life had just been really quite sad prior to Ryland's, you know, coming into the world. And it just solidified my love for Jeff, and just seeing a little person that, you know, is half me, half the man I love, and this little person that is my responsibility, truthfully, for the rest of their little life. I can't explain the magnitude of that feeling, but in the moment, I think I was just in pure awe of this little person. But yeah, looking back on it, I think I'm able to reflect more of what was going on at the moment. Yeah, I just think, you know, being a mother is so hard to put into words, but that moment for me was just magical, absolutely magical.
Right. Although just about everything is perfectly normal in the early going, even the very day that Ryland is born, somebody caring for her, I suppose one of the nurses or something, expresses just a little bit of concern that she seems a little sleepy and is not as alert as they would ideally want her to be. But nothing was said that day or in the days that followed to sort of sound alarm bells. The first moment that occurs is when you get a phone call from someone who is very, very concerned and thinks you need to have Ryland's hearing checked. Tell us about mm-hmm. that phone call and the shock that went through you.
Sure. But it was around Ryland's first birthday. And let me just preface that by saying that members of the family had made comments to me leading up to that day about Ryland's hearing. And being that Ryland was our first child, we didn't really have anything to compare Ryland to. We knew that it was typical for a child to begin to start talking around a year old. But Ryland was so visual that Ryland fooled us for a long, long time. We would walk into a room and call Ryland's name, and Ryland would turn to us, but it was because Ryland could see us. So visually, Ryland was very keen, and we really lived in denial for a couple of months leading up to Ryland's deaf diagnosis, because Ryland really had a great way of hiding, masking the fact that he wasn't hearing. But in that moment when my father-in-law called me, I had a lot of guilt that began to fall onto my shoulders, because I had actually seen many of the signs. And really, I think Jeff and I both had put it out of our minds. Nobody wants to believe that there's anything wrong with their child. And, you know, of course, now even looking back on video, we were constantly tapping Ryland to get his attention. And I was, without even realizing it, buying Ryland light-up toys, because that was the only positive reaction I could get from Ryland. In that moment, it was just a gush of emotion, thinking to myself, why have I been in denial for so long? And I wish that I would have paid closer attention. After that phone call, it was like almost instantaneous that I began doing my own tests. And it was very clear to us that day and that evening that Ryland could not hear. So I began the grieving process that day.
Grieving for the future that you had imagined for her, a future that was perhaps not going to play out anything close to what you had imagined or envisioned. I think one of the most poignant moments you describe at this point in the book, where you have just begun to really face this possibility, which very clearly was actually, in fact, a reality, that there was something wrong with Ryland's hearing. It's when you are with her at some kind of a class. And I believe this might be actually, by sort of strange coincidence, I think it was a baby sign language class. And you were already signed up for it without any conscious thought of the fact that your daughter might need to use sign language as somebody with profound hearing loss. Explain, first of all, just briefly, what prompted you to have her take part in this class, and then this really sad moment on, I think, the very first day as you see her with these other children.
Yeah, my very best friend at the time, who had a baby the same age as Ryland, had been talking about this class in our area for a few weeks, and I owe it all to her, because she had taken some sign language classes in college and sort of told me the benefits of even hearing children taking baby sign language classes. So it was really my friend Jen who prompted me to take that step into that class, and it was really ironic, just the timing of all of it, because I had another friend say to me, you know, earlier in Ryland's life that I should do it, and I kind of laughed it off and thought it was a little absurd, just not understanding how beneficial it really is. So, yeah, the timing of that was really interesting, but pretty phenomenal at the same time, because as soon as we introduced sign language to Ryland, you know, his vocabulary in sign language took off. So he had about 250 signs memorized by the time he actually had surgery. So in less than a year, he just soaked all of it up. It was pretty amazing.
But this moment is so poignant, where it's this first class and the teacher's kind of beginning with some music for everybody to enjoy together. And you write, the other babies in the room smile up at their mothers, shrill their voices and thrill, bounce to the music, flag their arms with the sound, all of them except for Ryland. Our little girl does nothing to respond to the music. It's as if she's in her own little world. The truth is beginning to crystallize. Ryland cannot hear. In this communal setting, the even heavier thought occurs to me. My daughter is left out of experiencing life as the other babies are. I mean, I think that really gets at the heart of something that for the rest of us on the outside looking in might miss. That is one mm-hmm. facet of what makes a situation like this so sad.
Yeah, it was devastating. It really was. And, you know, I feel guilty saying it now because I know the deaf community is very proud of who they are. And, you know, but I have to admit, as a hearing parent coming from a hearing family, to think of your child spending the rest of their life not being able to communicate with the world is a pretty devastating reality. And at the time, I didn't know about cochlear implants. And, you know, of course, I sat and pictured Rylan going to a special school and sitting at the family dinner table, not knowing what was going on sometimes. And, you know, just family events where we had extended family that didn't know sign language. And that's a really sad thought, to think of your child being left out of the world and possibly being bullied or, you know, anything like that. So yeah, it was definitely a very difficult reality for me.
You, of course, do learn about the implants that can, in fact, make a dramatic difference for her, and they did. And I also want you to share yet another poignant moment. It is on the 1st of July, as you are bringing Ryland in for the surgery for these implants to be made. You pass an entryway, and your husband, Jeff, notices the sign on that doorway, and it, in a sense, really puts what you were experiencing in perspective. You remember the moment I'm talking about?
I sure do. Yep, it was, you know, really what we were dealing with wasn't a matter of life and death. And there were parents right on the other side of that door who were worried that their children wouldn't be alive the next day. Really, you know, yeah, you have to think about that. We had a healthy child in all other aspects. Maybe would struggle in one way. But at the end of the day, we could always put our arms around our child and hug him and give him the best possible life we could and not fear that he would be, you know, we would lose him from his diagnosis.
Yeah, the doorway said pediatric oncology unit. And you write, I take his hand, I think of the families who have occupied the rooms inside this hallway, how all of them would probably trade places with us in a heartbeat. We're speaking with Hillary Whittington and talking about her book, Raising Ryland, Our Story of Parenting a Transgender Child with No Strings Attached. Early in the book, you refer, of course, to Ryland as she, as her, as your daughter. But, of course, we are about to probe into the other facet of this story, which is so intriguing. First, we should say just a quick word about the exciting day known as Activation Day, which was the day that these cochlear implants were, I guess, activated, and for the first time, Ryland was actually able to hear. As you recount, you have this video, and you're hoping that the video you're going to take is going to be one of those heartwarming videos that we see on YouTube of that beautiful moment when a child squeals in delight or laughs or cheers. It wasn't exactly that for you and Ryland.
No, you know, we did post the video at that time, but looking back on it now, you know, we didn't know what to expect. There were some children that smile, that love the sound. Ryland, for whatever reason, I believe now that Ryland's ears were turned up far too loud for his first activation appointment. But looking back on it, Ryland's body got very tense. And Ryland looked in my eyes, and I'll never forget the look. But it was a look of fear, and it really worried me. I wondered if I just hoped that Ryland would get used to the new sense that he was experiencing. And as a parent, it's just very difficult because I really didn't know what to do to help him like the sound. And so over the first, you know, few months, I had to really bribe Ryland with candy to wear his cochlear implants. And now looking back, I understand that I don't believe that they were activated the way that they should have been, and I think it was too loud for him. So yeah, it was definitely an exciting moment, but an intense moment as well.
Right. And it's interesting, too, how you describe your tenacious efforts in the weeks and months to follow to help build Ryland's skills with language. At one point you say, I have to make up for 2 years of lost hearing time. And in a sense, in doing so, trying to assuage the guilt you probably still felt it, that somehow missing this or not facing up to it sooner. But then, of course, a new reality asserts itself, which neither you nor your husband could possibly have been ready for, although there had been mild little signs that Ryland was very much a tomboy. And then one day you walk in to the house and Ryland is nowhere to be found. You eventually track down Ryland in a closet. Tell us what you saw.
Yeah, Ryland would begin sneaking off, and he would go hide in Jeff's closet and pull down Jeff's, you know, really nice clothes, his shirts and his ties, which at the time he never, ever wore because he was a firefighter. And he would get dressed up in his dad's clothes, and at the time he was a little girl. So for me, again, Ryland was my first child, so I didn't really know what to expect. But I wasn't angry that he wanted to dress up in his dad's clothes. It just got to a point where he would want to track around the house in clothes that were 10 sizes too large for him, and he began to ruin Jeff's nice pants and nice shirts. So it wasn't a big issue to me in the beginning. I just, what concerned me the most is that he said to me, please don't tell anybody. And that to me was sort of a red flag.
Right.
Why should Ryland be ashamed that he is dressing up like a boy? Right. So that was the concerning moment for me.
Right. By the way, I just have to remark, because we're trying to be, you know, careful and accurate here and so on. And you, of course, Ryland is your son, and to you, he is he. But of course, at this point in the book, and in a sense, at this point in the story, Ryland is a she. So when we're talking about, you know, I wasn't alarmed that he was dressing up in his father's clothes. In fact, in a sense, it was she dressing up in her father's clothes.
It's so just hard to go back for me. It's
of
so
course.
Awkward. And I feel like I'm almost harming Ryland by referring to him as she. And truthfully, if I could have written the whole book in he pronoun, I would have, but it would be very confusing.
Interesting. Right. And I only mention it, because I just want to make sure people are following this story and understanding that this was cause for alarm, and particularly the fact that, that Ryland at that point in time felt such shame, about this. Tell us about the battles that went on, and that escalated in intensity over time when it came to what Ryland was willing to wear, particularly outside of the house.
Oh my goodness, that was a nightmare. And I know that sounds crazy, but when you're dealing with a child fighting you on their clothing every single moment of every single day, it gets to be very, very exhausting. And you finally just get to a point where you give up. And so with Ryland, I started off by buying gender-neutral colors. I would go to the girls' department and I would buy, you know, just plain colors in cuts that weren't very feminine, if I could. And Ryland would wear it, and eventually Ryland got a box of hand-me-down boy clothes from a friend of mine. And once Ryland got his hands on some actual boy clothing, it was really difficult to get that clothing off of Ryland. And I would have to coach Ryland for weeks leading up to an event. Hey, Ryland, we're going to wear this. And I would have to, you know, really just coach him and bribe him. And I know that's not great parenting practice, but it was very, very, very difficult, but possible, to get Ryland into girls' clothing. And part of that came from the fact that, you know, Jeff was gone quite a bit at the fire department. So essentially I felt like a single parent fighting this uphill battle. And, you know, it got to a point when I was pregnant with Brinley, our second child, that I started to feel pre-pregnancy contractions while I was fighting Rylan into an outfit. And I hit a moment of just absolute, I hit my wall. Because I thought to myself, here I am, possibly going into preterm labor because I'm trying to fight my child into clothing to make other family members happy.
Mm.
And I just realized that this was not healthy for me or for Rylan. And I could, it felt to me like child abuse at one point. When you see your child, you know, just hysterically crying, foaming at the mouth practically, because he's so upset that I'm trying to put him in a dress.
Right.
And I just realized, for who am I doing this?
Right.
You know?
You also come to understand something which had been also a very significant cause for concern, namely Rylan's bedwetting and mm-hmm. and having accidents. And you came eventually to understand that there was probably a purpose for those mm-hmm. so-called accidents, in a sense. And it's probably mm-hmm. so good that you came to this understanding. What did you come to realize or believe about all the accidents that Rylan was having?
You know, there's so many different ways to look at that. But for me, at least in the daytime, when I saw Rylan wetting his pants a lot, it could have been many things. But one of the things it could have been is the fact that he didn't want to wear something. And he knew that if he had an accident in an outfit he didn't want to wear, he wouldn't have to wear it. So it could have been that. It could have been just the grief of him internally knowing that he was a boy and us not realizing it. And as a small child, how much control do you really have? You know, so I'm sure children find any way that they possibly can to control their situation. And I think for Rylan, that was one of them. Again, I think he is also, he's deaf and he works really, really hard during the day to hear and listen and know what's going on. It's so much that I don't even realize it sometimes. And I think that's another part of it. When he sleeps at night, he is just so exhausted that was another maybe part of it. But anyhow, there's no way for me to know exactly why he was doing it. But I can tell you that during the day when he was doing it, it had something to do with him not wanting to wear certain clothing.
Right. Another way in which this played out, and I think this is also something that a lot of us would never think about until reading it in your book, is the matter of when Rylan would be given gifts at, for instance, mm-hmm. birthday parties, or for no particularly special occasion, but the thing that grandparents do on a regular basis when they come back from a trip and they have a present for Rylan. Rylan was only interested, only excited in masculine-themed toys or clothing or whatever, and mm-hmm. you had to work so hard to make sure that Rylan would be polite and not express shock or dismay or disgust if mm-hmm. if given, in a sense, a standard girl gift. I have a feeling that was something you never saw coming, in a sense.
Oh, it was so stressful and so, as a parent, so hard, because I think we all want our children to be polite and respond with thank yous and, you know, to have gratification, just to be grateful for gifts. And I cringed every single time someone got Rylan a gift, because I knew that there would be disappointment, and I knew that you can't really hide that. You know, I mean, you could just see it on his face when he opened something that was intended for a little girl. It was almost like, how could you do this, and why are you giving me this? So, I mean, thank goodness over time our family caught on to it, and they quickly got on board and would get Rylan, you know, superhero gifts and things like that. But there's just really no way to control a child's reaction to a present in front of people. So that was a really stressful, horrible time for me, because I wanted to make it better, and the only way I could make it better was by telling people ahead of time what Rylan liked. Mm. So it was hard.
Right.
For sure.
Of course, at some point, you and your husband, Jeff, begin to confront this reality that this is not a fad, that it's not easing off. If anything, it is growing more intense by the day. And you have to come to terms with this somehow and decide what you are going to do about it. And as you say in the book, and I think it's one of the trickiest points to make, I think you do it well. Never for a moment did your husband Jeff stop loving Ryland, but mm-hmm. it was a little harder for him, evidently, to come to grips with this reality. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about his reaction, that hesitancy, that reluctance. I mean, just how significant was that? I mean, what was the nature of his struggles to understand and accept this reality about Ryland?
Well, for Jeff, he'll admit to you that for him, he avoided it altogether because out of fear. He was afraid that Ryland would have one more thing to make him a subject of bullying or, you know, just to set him apart from the crowd. And I think as a parent, he was afraid of this reality. So he did anything in his power to avoid talking to me about it. You know, we were on completely opposite pages for a long time. And again, a lot of it came from the fact that I was with Ryland all of the time, and Jeff was working really hard to provide, so he wasn't around a ton. And also, Ryland picked up on the fact that Ryland could tell me certain things, and they were received differently than when he would tell Jeff certain things. So, Jeff will admit to you that it took him much longer to get on board and to understand this. But for him, the moment of understanding really came when we went to a support group here in town, and he started to hear the stories of the other families going through this. And once he started to hear some of those devastating, heartbreaking, horrible stories from other families, his eyes opened much wider, and he realized that we couldn't ignore this any longer.
Right. And I guess what you're saying there is it was your belief, already your belief, and it became Jeff's belief as well, that by mm-hmm. allowing Ryland to transition now rather than waiting for years from now, you would be helping Ryland to avoid years of a very special and sort of cruel kind of heartbreak. If mm-hmm. you could allow Ryland to be who he was at this point in time, even though Ryland was only five, this was the best way to ensure his happiness and well-being.
Absolutely. Yep.
I wonder if you could also tie in something very significant, which was the story of your brother. You mentioned very briefly earlier in the interview that your brother died not long before Ryland was born. And mm-hmm. and I don't think we've yet mentioned that your brother had struggled for years and years with very serious substance abuse. So his life was difficult. Things were turning around, and then his unexpected death was a terrible blow for you. You mention your brother and his death and his difficult life at the point in the book when you are talking with Jeff about Ryland. What is the heart of that connection?
The heart of the connection is just that I watched my brother struggle most of his life, trying to fit in and not being a very confident person for whatever reason. And, you know, after seeing him struggle his whole life, and then, of course, losing him tragically at such a young age, it just prepares me and equips me with a lot more than most parents. I think I know deep down that I never want to see my child struggling like my brother did. And, you know, although it may be for different reasons, I also know that I don't want Ryland to fall into that 41% attempted suicide rate, because I've already lost someone so close to me, and I can't even fathom losing anyone else close to me. So for me, I felt that losing my brother and just what I had gone through with him sort of gave me the foundation to do what I needed to do for Ryland so that he doesn't fall into that path, really.
Hmm. When you decide that you will allow Ryland to transition, that is, to live life as a boy, which is Ryland's fervent wish. One of the points of contention is about Ryland's hair. Talk a moment about a moment when Ryland said something to you about this matter of hair, and why you think ultimately this was a very important, in a sense, moment of passage for him in his transition.
Are you referring to the time when he said, "When the family dies, I will
yes.
cut my hair"?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm sorry. Can you just repeat exactly?
Sure. I want you to tell our listeners about, kind of describe that moment, and ultimately then that first time that Ryland's hair is cut to that of a boy, in a sense, and what you think that represented in terms of a significant point in his transition.
Absolutely. So I think for Ryland, he was already dressing much like a boy at this time. You know, he, for the most part, he was wearing mostly boys' clothing, and he had this long hair that I would still try and put bows in. It was a terrible fight as well. But I think for Ryland, cutting his hair was the sort of final piece that he needed to look at himself in the mirror and look at the person that he felt he was inside. At the same time, we knew that that was a huge step as a family, because then Ryland would be really presenting in the world as a boy. So we knew that once Ryland cut his hair, we needed to explain things to people and really take that next step to change pronouns. And Jeff didn't want to take Ryland. At the time, we still had a Ryland as our daughter. He didn't want to take Ryland down to his very Catholic barber shop that he was.
Emergency alert system. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. That interruption is in an interview in which you are hearing from Hillary Whittington, the author of a memoir called Raising Ryland, Our Story of Parenting a Transgender Child with No Strings Attached. We'll try to rejoin the interview as it's proceeding so you're not missing any of this conversation. Please stand by.
Of people's reactions. So looking back on it, I think I would have done that differently. But yeah, that's sort of how it all went down. I mean, at the time, we didn't know how to take that next step, and we didn't know what to do. And so we just sort of took it into our own hands. And once Ryland had a terrible haircut by me, then Jeff was able to take him down and have it fixed.
There you go. And I wonder if... Is this the closest you ever came to telling Ryland in so many words, we're going to allow you to live as a boy now? I mean, you never really describe exactly a moment where those exact words get said, but do you think that's what this represented to Ryland?
I think so. To be honest with you, Ryland's confidence just sort of began to grow instantly, the second we started referring to Ryland as he and our son. It was almost like you could see his shoulders perk up and, you know, his chest chest puff out a little bit every single time we began calling him our son. And so, yeah, it was a sort of a progression over time. And to be honest with you, his hyper-masculinity from before has completely dissipated, meaning that, you know, before he transitioned, he would only drink out of a blue cup. He would only eat off of a blue plate. He would never, ever be got dead playing with a girl toy or something pink. And it's crazy because now that we've affirmed him and he knows that we see him as our son, he's really relaxed. And now he will eat off a pink plate if that's the only one that's clean. So it's really just been remarkable to watch the whole transition take place.
I want us to take a moment to just talk about the matter of as he went to school and the fact that you actually seem to have been very fortunate to send him to a school that was really quite sensitive to the situation. And it sounds like also he's been blessed to have really, really great supportive friends. But you mentioned in the chapter called Educating the Educators that one of the most tricky balancing acts was that you wanted everyone who worked at that school to understand Ryland's story. And yet, in your words, we didn't want the word to get out that Ryland is the odd kid out at school whose presence demands this training or who needs special treatment. It's a balance that we need to strike between preparing the adults and kids around Ryland and preventing stigma. I bet that really is a tricky matter, to prepare everybody around Ryland for Ryland's uncommon situation and yet wanting him also to be treated like a normal kid.
Right. And, it's really hard because we wanted everyone to understand it, but at the same time, we had to sort of, quote-unquote, out ourselves in front of everyone in order to allow them to really connect to what was happening. And that was something that we struggled with. We were told that it isn't really a good thing for us to do a training at our son's school because then everybody knows that that's our son, you know, that's transgender. But really, we struggled with it, and we just realized that if we wanted everyone to really understand what this was like for us, we felt that we were the ones best to do that. So it was a very, very thin, it was a hard line to walk, but we did.
Well, it's an amazing story, and it's so uplifting and encouraging in that people have been remarkably responsive and sensitive and welcoming. There have been tough times, of course, as well, and you share about that as well. But overall, it is an incredibly positive story. What can you tell us about how Ryland is doing today?
Ryland is doing amazing. He is your typical 8-year-old little boy. But he's great in school. He's a very, very good reader, and he's top of his class in his math and knows more about computers than I do, has more friends than I can even tell you. We're just trying to live a normal life, and I think that's been the really hard balance of all of this, is that we really want people to understand, but at the same time, we want his life to be typical. We don't want him to feel like there's this huge spotlight on him. So it's been a very delicate balance. I really believe that by us coming out and sharing our story now, hopefully I'm taking the burden off of him so that later he doesn't feel like he has to explain himself to everyone. But at the same time, you know, we're dealing with a child, and so we're very, very careful with what we allow Ryland to hear and see, because I don't really want him to know that people are being murdered because of this, and children are killing themselves because of this. I mean, those are some pretty heavy things. I don't necessarily want him to know right now. So, for the most part, he's a really typical kid, and we live a really